they all have to join a union. And as soon as they join the union, their character changes. There are certain rules of how many hours a day you can rehearse. There are certain rules of how many weeks of rehearsing. They bring this down like a sledgehammer on the whole thing. And then there are two mentalities. There's the mentality of security, of money, and there's the mentality of the open risk, you know? What this comes to is a conflict of the art, creative art, and economic security. And I don't think I've seen it in other cultures. The artist doesn't have to buck against quite the odds that he has to buck against today.
The artist is honored in other cultures.
He is honored.
Yes.
And quickly honored. Here,
it's a struggle. Non-profit organizations,
time, yeah.
And the whole route of the struggle.
Or you might just hit it off something that really strikes the need and requirements of the day, and then you've given your gift early, you know. But basically, it's a real risk. And I think that's so in any adventure. Even in business, the man who has the idea of a new kind of gift to society, you know, that, and he's willing to risk it. And then the workers come in and claim that they're the ones that did it, you know, and he can't afford even to perform his performance. It's a conflict, I think, between the security and the creativity idea. The entrepreneur is a creator. He's running a risk.
Maybe in American capitalistic society, the entrepreneur is the creative hero in some sense.
Oh, I think he is. I mean, the real one. Most people go into economic activities not for risk, but for security. Do
yes.
you see what I mean? And
sure.
the other psychology tends to take over.
Joseph, in that same chapter on The Call and The Hero with a Thousand Faces, you wrote, "The myths and folktales of the whole world make clear that the refusal of The Call, is essentially a refusal to give up what one takes to be one's own interest." And then you go on to say about how we get fixed in our own security and mm-hmm. our own ideals and are reluctant to see them change.
Yeah, and it can even get so that you can't make them change.
And it brings up the whole connection of myth to the adventure
yes.
that I'm talking about.
Yes.
I'd like to hear you talk about that.
Well, the myths, there is a kind of regular morphology and inevitable sequence of experiences if you start out to follow your adventure. I don't care whether it's in economics, in art, or just in play. The sense of potentialities and these opening out before you, and you have no idea how to achieve them. You start out into the dark, and then strange little helpmates come along, represented frequently by little fairy spirits or little gnomes or something like this that gives you just a clue, and this opens out. And then the sense of dangers you always run into, really deep perils, because no one has gone this way before. And the winds blow, and you're in a forest of darkness and terror very often, and then hanging on through that and all. It's something when I wrote that was 40 years ago. I was writing out of what I had read, you know, and now I've lived it. And I know it's correct. In fact, I was greatly moved by my own writing when you were reading that. I thought, gee, did I write that? That's how it turned out. I mean, it's valid. These mythic clues work.
Part of that, too, and this is interesting because this is a quote that one normally doesn't hear at the podium on Sundays in the average Christian church, and that is, dread the passage of Jesus, for he does not return. What does that passage mean to you in the context of what we've been talking about?
Jesus represents the inspiration to life. I mean, the life of the spirit, the life not simply of physical conditions, but the thing that is life for man, namely a spiritual adventure. And he comes and is the awakener, And if you close your mind to that awakener, you may not come back again. You can lose it. I think there are many myths, many epic stories of the awakening, which then has passed, and you can't even think what it was. You know, you can't think what it was. There's an extremely interesting psychological story of a woman in the hills of West Virginia, a mining area, who, when she was a little girl, walking through the woods, heard a wonderful music. And when she got home, she forgot what it was. Now, this is a woman in her late 60s who felt that she had missed her life. And it was only while in psychoanalysis that it came out that that song that she had heard was the call. Now, this, curiously, is precisely the problem of the shaman, the young person who is alone on the seashore or in the forest and hears a music. Now, those people have the knowledge that that music must somehow be followed. You must stay with it. And it may make a lonely life for you, but that is your life. And this, to me, was a very interesting thing. I'm sure that in our world, where all emphasis is put on success and all of that, that song is heard and forgotten by young people. That's the missing of the call. Beware the passing of Jesus, for he may not return.
Does the call only occur when you're young?
Oh, no. It first occurs when you're young. You know that lovely poem of Wordsworth on recollections of immortality, intimations of immortality. Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The soul that comes with us, it's come from God and all this kind of thing. And he tells then of the prison house beginning to close upon the growing boy, but we can still hear the children singing on the seashore, you know? But it may get closed down. On the other hand, if you stay open, you not only hear the song, but you hear it in greater symphonic composition as you go on. And then you know that you're still on the track.
What does contemporary religion have to do with the adventure? Anything?
I think contemporary religion's in a very bad spot. And it's because they have taken the symbols as the reference. And, for instance, the symbol, I'm speaking it now, religion is a constellation of metaphors. And a metaphor points to connotations that are of the spirit, not of history. And in our religions, we're accenting the historical image that carries the message, but we stay with the image.
So the literal interpretation of
words.
Yeah,
and you lose these messages. The thing about Jesus is not that he died and was resurrected, but that his death and resurrection must tell us something about our own spirit.
Why do you think that we do tend to this literal interpretation of the words? Why does that occur?
I think it's the result of a strong institutional emphasis in our religions in the West and a fear of the mystical experience. In fact, the experience of the divine within you is regarded as blasphemy, you see. I remember having given a lecture once on this problem of becoming transparent to transcendence, so that your life becomes, as it were, a transparency through which some kind of light shines. And I spoke of it as the God in you coming out through your life. And a couple of months later, I met a young woman at another talk of some kind, and she said, "Oh, I was at that lecture you gave on this subject, and I was sitting beside a priest, and when you said the Christ in you asks you to live in that sense, he said, that's heresy. That's blasphemy." Blasphemy was the word that he used. Okay, So all the spirit is out there somewhere, not in you.